Lassen Sie uns doch diesen.
The compulsory celibacy is something we largely reject.
Priestly celibacy, ordaining women, and gender ideology. The alarming proposals from church leaders in Germany and analysis on the potential for a new schism.
Viva el Papa!
Pope Francis's 10th anniversary as Shepherd of the Church, how Argentinians are celebrating. Plus, tweeting the gospel. A look at the Holy Father's impact as the first digital pope.
I'm Colm Flynn, and coming up on the program, we'll be traveling right across the Emerald Isle, reporting on the state of the Catholic Church in Ireland today.
EWTN News In Depth starts now.
Es hat von Anfang an.
From the beginning, there have been attempts to delegitimize the process, but there hasn't been success.
Synodal showdown, women's ordination, same-sex blessings, and more are voted on in Frankfurt. At the fifth and final assembly of the German Synodal Path, launched in 2019, delegates ratified sweeping reform in direct opposition to church teaching. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. Critics say the repercussions of this assembly could lead to the church in Germany splitting from the Holy See. Lay groups are warning of a dirty schism, where faithful Catholics in Germany could be pushed underground.
We have to look at the bigger picture and determine the consequences of abuse. It has been poisoning so many realities.
The German Synodal Way was initially launched in 2019 in response to a clerical sex abuse report in Germany that indicated that between 1946 and 2014, more than 3,600 minors, mostly boys, suffered some type of sexual attack by more than 1,600 clergymen. The report, carried out by a consortium of universities and reported on by multiple news outlets, noted that the actual number of victims may be much higher. The German Synodal Path has brought together some 200 participants, including bishops, priests, nuns, and laity over the years, largely chosen from the radical Central Committee of German Catholics, to discuss the power in the church, the priesthood, the role of women in the church, and sexuality.
I'm convinced that opening up celibacy will not be a loss for the church.
Despite letters of warning from the Vatican and Pope Francis denouncing the meetings as canonically invalid and not faithful to Francis's vision of synodality, as well as a letter from more than 100 international bishops expressing concerns over a potential new schism, participants continued the controversial process. Last weekend was the culmination of several years' work pushing for what participants call reform in the church that many others are calling heretical. Delegates overwhelmingly voted in favor of adopting same-sex blessings, a practice we saw German priests perform 2 years ago in defiance of Rome. Bishop Georg Beitzing denies that the blessings could send mixed messages.
And I said it during the opening press conference, we do not want to conflate blessing with the sacrament of matrimony.
Participants also voted in favor of reevaluating church teaching on homosexuality, permitting lay preaching, asking Rome to reexamine priestly celibacy, and advancing the discussion of allowing women into the diaconate.
Opening the diaconate for women is an important step, but I think that above and beyond that, we need perspectives that all the ministries will open up.
Members went on to vote to implement a text on gender diversity. The vote on gender ideology calls for changes to baptismal records to match gender identity, banning one's gender identity from consideration for pastoral ministerial roles, and mandatory education for priests and church employees to deal with the topic of gender diversity. They also agreed to bar external sexual characteristics from being used as criteria to accept a man as a candidate for the priesthood, which opens the door for attempted ordinations of women. Just days before the final day of the German assembly, Pope Francis blasted gender ideology as a thought process that erases humanity. In an interview published on March 10th with the Argentine daily newspaper La Nación, the Holy Father is quoted saying, "Gender ideology today is one of the most dangerous ideological colonizations. Why is it dangerous? Because it blurs the differences and the value of men and women."
There are people in the diocese who have difficulties with the resolutions, difficulties with the dynamic.
While the assembly did not create an official permanent national synodal council, a red line that the Vatican drew weeks ago, members did vote on forming a transitional committee to establish a permanent synodal council in the next 3 years. Jonathan Liedl, senior editor for the National Catholic Register, has been following the German synodal path closely and attended the gathering in person. He's written multiple articles on all of the issues church leaders are working to implement in the church. And he joins us now from Berlin to talk more about it. Jonathan, great to have you here. You were providing blow-by-blow coverage of the assembly on Twitter. Do these 200 participants in the synodal path actually represent the church in Germany?
That's a fantastic question. I think they. I think an argument can be made that they represent. They're a representative slice of the 22 million people in Germany who claim to be Catholic. However, among those 22 million people, only 5% go to Mass. There's a deep crisis, multi-generational catechesis in Germany. So, among those Catholics who believe in the universal faith, who practice the faith sacramentally, go to Mass. No, the synodal way is not representative of them. And in fact, before it even kicked off in Frankfurt this past week, five different delegates quit the process because they cited how it was a prearranged agenda and how they cited it was throwing into doubt central aspects of the Catholic faith. So that's a deep concern of whether this is actually representative of people in the pews, people who are faithful here in Germany.
Before we go into that back and forth, we've seen video of supporters and opponents of the German Synod. How large are each of these groups outside of the assembly?
Well, on different days of the assembly, there were different groups gathered. On the first day, you had representatives from Maria 1.0, which is a Catholic group that says Mary doesn't need an update. But you also had pretty sizable groups representing LGBTQ interests in the church. They call it Out in Church here in Germany. And then also a sizable group demonstrating for attempted women's ordination. So I think the different groups, I think one thing we need to keep in mind is that in Germany, the Catholic Church employs 800,000 people. And that's because the church here is enriched by something called the church tax, right? Where people, if they indicate Catholic on their sort of census form, money is automatically going into the church coffers. So the church employs 800,000 people, while only 900,000 people here go to Mass on Sunday. And those two groups don't overlap. So in essence, what you have is a lot of people who work for the church, are involved in church-related activities, who don't even share the beliefs and the faiths and the commitments of the Catholic Church. And so you see a lot of groups that claim to be Catholic that are Catholic in name, and they're certainly loud and they're certainly influential. But I think the deeper question is whether they are, in fact, representative, again, of the Catholic faith in Germany.
That's right. You're looking at this reality of 22 million people who say that they're Catholic, identify as Catholic, are incentivized to do so, but only about 900,000 who are really in the life of the church attending Mass on Sunday. We know that some priests and religious have decided to stay out of the synodal way. They've opted out. Others have decided to stay and participate. How are they dealing, the ones that have decided to stay, with the pressure to vote in a certain way or another?
I think that's a fantastic question. I mean, honestly, I think there are few lay people left who perhaps don't share the animating vision and animating commitment of the Synodal Way, and specifically the Central Committee for German Catholics, which is a very powerful lay movement in Germany that is sort of dictating terms here. Among the bishops, though, I think it's very difficult. I think the best way to describe the situation in Germany among the 67 bishops or so is that You have some who are certainly ideologically committed to all the proposals you've already mentioned, the women priests, the same-sex blessings, incorporate transgender ideology into the practice of the church. You have kind of a mushy middle, if you will, and then you have maybe a small third, right, that is trying to resist these changes. But what's happened since September, the last assembly of the Synodal Way, and then this past week, is that they got rid of secret voting. They got rid of the secret ballot. They did that after one-third of the bishops voted against a base text on sexuality that was deeply problematic and heterodoxical in a number of ways. And so one-third of bishops, if they vote against something, it vetoes it. In response to that, a very kind of draconian measure to get rid of the secret ballot. And so really, if you see the votes that happened this past, this past assembly on issues of transgender ideology, on issues of same-sex blessings, votes that were directly supposed to be based on that text that got rejected back in September, what you saw is that in a number of instances, instead of 20 bishops voting against it and 3 abstaining, the number of bishops voting for it fell all the way down to 7, and you had in the range of 13 abstaining from it. So a lot of people are looking at it and saying, this is the same group that was able to vote back in September against that text on sexuality. But now that the votes are public, so many
they're
bishops
changing their minds.
They don't feel comfortable going public, and that's why so many of these things were able to be passed. And I think, again, that indicates the immense amount of pressure and manipulation that these powerful lay groups and lay employees in the German Catholic Church can exert upon the bishops here.
An environment of coercion, for sure. But outside of the assembly, some dioceses have already blessed same-sex unions. Will those dioceses that have not now felt able to do so, will they feel obliged to follow these new edicts that go against church teaching? Will Catholic faithful be forced underground for wanting to be true to the magisterium?
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic question because, of course, Bishop Batzing at the final press conference, he said to people who might have had concerns about all these different proposals passed, what have we taken away from you, right? You'll live your lives, or bishops in these different dioceses who still want to be faithful to Rome, what have we done to you? But I think the reality on the ground is that there will be a ripple effect. Recently, the German bishops agreed on a new revised labor law that prevents people being removed from ministerial positions for going against church teaching or identifying as transgender, all kinds of things. And the conversations I've had in private indicate that even in the diocese where we think the bishops are rock solid and we think that there's a vibrant kind of Catholic life going on, that there will be an impact, that there will be an effect. So what I've heard from a lot of people right now in Germany is they're asking the question of whether I need to leave the church to remain Catholic. Do I need to stop paying the church tax and disaffiliate, which is a significant issue? I think we can't understand in America because we don't have it. But in a place like Germany where being Catholic or being Protestant is so significant to your identity, to disaffiliate, it technically bars you from the sacraments in the German church. And so there is a real sense among the faithful here, in good conscience, can I still participate in what is allegedly the official Catholic Church if it's promoting things that are so heterodoxical and so clearly in violation of what the church actually teaches. So an ongoing situation, I think a lot of people don't know, to be honest with you.
And they don't understand the actual context and the relationship between the church and the government. Really quickly, Jonathan, have other comments from the Vatican or Pope Francis been impactful? Does more need to be done there?
Well, I think we did see some impact, right? You mentioned the letter that was written by the 3 Vatican cardinals telling the German Synodal Way not to establish a synodal council. But look what the Germans did. They basically put everything in place to get the synodal council moving without technically crossing that red line. And so they're going to go to the Vatican, the Synod on Synodality coming up in October, both this year and next year. They really see that as a key strategic moment to push their ideas in the rest of the church. They also had discussions about whether promotional videos or other tactics are needed to promote the ideas of the Synodal Way in places like Africa and places like Asia. So I think the Vatican has used words, but the Germans they're very tactful, strategic in what they're doing. And I think the sense of the faithful on the ground is a desperate need for Rome to do something more than just use words, but to actually step in with discipline. So a great desire for that, a sense that that's what's needed, but not not a lot of confidence that that's guaranteed to happen.
Well, Jonathan, we will keep relying on you on this developing story, watching for what you're seeing on the ground. Really appreciate you being with us.
Thank you, Monson.
You can read more of Jonathan Liedl's coverage of the German Synodal Way on the websites of our sister organizations, the National Catholic Register and the Catholic News Agency. Next up on EWTN News In Depth, how the Church in Argentina celebrated Pope Francis's 10th anniversary on the seat of St. Peter. And still to come, the case that could stop half the abortions in the United States. The hearing held this week.
Pope, he wants to help the people to have a personal encounter with Christ.
Outreach to the poor and marginalized, dialogue and diplomacy. The Apostolic Nuncio to the U.S. shares his thoughts on Pope Francis's leadership in this first 10 years of his papacy. And more fallout between the Church and President Daniel Ortega's dictatorship in Nicaragua. The new moves made to break any relations with the Holy See.
Viva el Papa! Catholics in Argentina celebrated the 10th anniversary of Jorge Mario Bergoglio as Supreme Pontiff on Monday. At the Basilica of Our Lady of Luján, Cardinal Mario Aurelio Poli, successor of Bergoglio in the Archdiocese of Buenos Aires, concelebrated a Mass in honor of the Holy Father. Of course, Catholics around the world are also celebrating Pope Francis's decade on the throne of St. Peter. But his home country of Argentina takes his papacy a little more personally. A small congregation at the Virgen de Cacupé, a small chapel in one of Buenos Aires's largest slums, where Francis regularly visited before he became Pope, also held a Mass for him. Francis was known for his closeness to the faithful, making public appearances and Masses in the most diverse places, even when he already held the high office of Cardinal Bishop.
To celebrate the 10 years of this Pope, who has a poor church for the poor, moves our heart. And also, it makes us proud that we have a Pope from Argentina who walked our neighborhoods.
Many people praise the chapel as a connection to the social justice values Pope Francis continually raises as leader of our faith. Francis's work with the poor and marginalized is a hallmark of his papacy. But there are many others. We spoke with the Apostolic Nuncio of the Holy See to the United States, Archbishop Christophe Pierre, about Pope Francis's impact around the world. Archbishop Christophe Pierre, thank you so much for joining us. Let's talk about Pope Francis's papacy these 10 wonderful years. What part of his papacy has had the greatest impact so far?
Well, you know, I have been nuncio since, you know, I was already nuncio when Pope Francis was elected. And may I say, perhaps, the main thing for me has been the desire of the Pope, and also this determination to evangelize. You know? And he realizes that there is a need of a new evangelization, which, by the way, is not new in the church. We heard about it.
That's right. And that encounter, it's based on something that you've said over and over again. It's based on dialogue. What do you think is the best example of this charismatic, Christ-encountering dialogue?
Well, you know, it's the Pope feels that we... there is an absolute necessity to encounter the people where they are and as they are. And at times, you know, this is a source of scandal. But the problem is that if you read well all the documents of the Pope, if you listen to his homilies, you know, the dialogue is crucial. It's very important. But the dialogue is not just for the sake of dialoguing. It's to express, you know, our interest to the people and to help the people, you know, to become aware of people who have something to offer, the testimony of the Christians. And the aim is also to provide an encounter with Christ. So this is, he wants a church which is dialoguing with the people in order to give the testimony of a presence in their life, which will lead them to conversion.
His papacy has also focused on the encounter between the young and the old. Is yes. this likely to continue? And is it likely to be featured in the World Youth Day in Lisbon?
I hope so. I think, you know, you know, I think it's very interesting, you know, because the Holy Father is very concerned about the young people, especially because, you know, he has realized that, you know, the difficulty to offer, you know, the mystery of God's presence, you yes. know, in the humanity to the young generations. There is a kind of gap. Even inside the family, you know, the parents are concerned because they cannot transmit their faith, you know, to their children. And it happens also in the school, it happens in the parishes. The priests are concerned, you know, there is a lack of vocations and so on. All the problems you realize today, you know. Yes. And there is a reason for that. You know, there is a kind of cultural breakdown, you know, at all levels. So the Pope wants a church which is very attentive to these dimensions, you know, yes. the need of evangelizations. But it's also amazing to note how the Pope speaks about the old people. He's himself an old man, you know.
Yes.
He's young old man, you know. But you know, I think the Holy Father speaks a lot about the necessity for the young people to be attentive to the what you call the abuelos, you know,
yes.
the grandfather, the grandmothers, the old people, and the old people to be attentive to the young.
It's a beautiful encounter. Pope Francis has tried to foster greater diplomatic efforts with countries like China and Russia, even as tensions and differences build after the Ukrainian invasion with the several problems that we've had with the Chinese government. Has this inspired you in your diplomatic role, the ability to continue dialogue while living in this great tension?
Yes. Well, indeed, you know, I've been a diplomat of the church for 46 years, you know, in many circumstances. And this is why we are being sent into the world, you know, not to condemn the world, to help the world to be better, you know. And I know that some people are not happy, you know, because, for example, in China, you know, there is the Vatican has a kind of agreement, and nobody, we will never be completely happy with the kind of agreements, but agreements, you know, in the world are imperfect, but we are on the way of change in the world. So this is the logic of dialogue. When you dialogue with somebody, you don't necessarily agree with these people. But as soon as you are able, you know, to dialogue, something is changes. It's changing. So, for example, in the circumstance with Russia, with China, at times the relationships are difficult, but we don't give up, and we hope on the beauty of dialogue. And I think this is what the Pope wants. So we are on the way. And indeed, as you ask me, you know, I've always been inspired, you know, by the faith of the Holy Father. In spite of all the critics he receives, you know, he's very serene, and just, that's the way. And let's go in that direction.
Do you have any insights into Pope Francis's recent public comments on gender ideology and why he felt compelled to comment on this again in a statement and in an interview? This is this public dialogue that he's having with the church on gender ideology.
The role of the church is education of the people. So if we find that in some ideologies are pushing in some directions, we as Christians, he as the Pope, he has every right, you know, to offer, you know, reflections. We do not necessarily condemn the people, but we indicate the way and we help the people to reflect. You know, I see the church as a kind of educator of the humanity. And I like to see also the Holy Father, a kind of great spiritual father of the humanity. Why not? You know, this is his role. This is his vocation, and this should be also our vocation ourselves, wherever we are, as bishops, as priests, you know, in our role, you know, we should never give up, you know, deep reflections, because otherwise, you know, we are there not to condemn the world, but to help the world and the people, you know.
Well, we're grateful for those moments of clarity, and they give us great hope, as you mentioned.
Certainly. I always, it's interesting. I don't know if you have noticed during the last few days, you know, everybody speaks about Pope Francis, you know.
Yes.
At times, people repeat themselves, you know, like the journalists, they like to repeat themselves, you know, over and over. But it's interesting. I've read most of the things I've been able to read. But you have also, I've heard the Pope Francis has given quite a number of interviews, you know.
Yes.
To many journalists of all categories of journalists. And, you know, these interviews are part of his magisterium in some way, given in a simple way, in a spirit of dialogue, but he always expresses a few very important aspects. And, you know, his reflections about gender ideology were given to, in a simple reflection with a journalist. But, you know, we listen, and it helps us to think.
Absolutely. It's necessary, and we're grateful for it. Archbishop, thank you for your time, for your witness, for the great celebration of these 10 years. We're hoping for the blessings of many more.
Certainly. Let's pray for the Holy Father and pray for the Church.
We continue our coverage of Pope Francis's 10th anniversary after the break with a look at how the Holy Father reaches out to the faithful right on their phones. His impact in the digital sphere next.
This has been a very difficult decision, not taken lightly.
A U.S. diocese declares bankruptcy after a deluge of sex abuse lawsuits. Will Catholic schools be impacted? That story ahead. Plus, an alarming new study on maternal mortality rates in the United States. The community's experts say are suffering from higher death rates.
While Catholic doctrine is unchanging, the Church's outreach has always evolved with the times. As we continue our coverage of Pope Francis's 10th anniversary, we wanted to look at how he's brought the throne of St. Peter closer to his flock, particularly through social media. Rudolf Gehrig shares how Francis has distinguished himself as the digital pope.
It was almost 2,000 years ago that St. Paul the Apostle stood in ancient Athens and boldly proclaimed the gospel. The proclamation of the gospel is inseparably part of the DNA of the Church. This has not changed over the years. What has changed, however, are the means of communication. For centuries, popes could communicate mainly by writings. In 1931, that changed when Pius XI founded the Vatican radio station. For the first time, people around the world could hear the voice of Peter's successor over the radio.
Quello che l'occhio non vede e che la mano.
Almost 50 years later, Pope John Paul II founded the Vatican television station CTV. Television suddenly made the Holy Father a global media star. In 2005, Josef Ratzinger was elected Pope. The age of the Internet began. December 12, 2012 became a historic day in the media history of the Church. Pope Benedict was the first pope ever to write a tweet. With Francis, the new pope not only took over the chair of Peter in 2013, but also Benedict's Twitter account. Daniel Arasa, who works as a communications consultant for the Vatican, has followed how the pope's communications strategy has evolved.
The explosion of the social media has come later with the current Pope, or during the papacy of Pope Francis. So certainly the continuity of using the media, the social media in this case, has also exploded in the sense that the Vatican today is using many social media and the Pope is a star, we can say.
Today, social media giants like Twitter, Instagram and YouTube are important tools for the Pontiff to stay in touch with his flock.
Pope Francis, in my opinion, is reminding every day with his words, with his gestures, even more than words, the importance of relation with God. a merciful God, and how this relationship, this friendship with Jesus, with the merciful God, can change our life forever. So I think this is the real core. The most important thing is doing even on a communication level.
The importance of the media was particularly impressive when the coronavirus pandemic broke out. Not only social life, but also church life in the community threatened to die out.
La tua presenza di padre.
The picture went around the world when Pope Francis gave the blessing Urbi et Orbi in the deserted St. Peter's Square in March 2020. Francis knows the importance of the media for the church. This shows his decision to beatify Carlo Acutis in October 2020. Carlo, an Italian teenager, died of leukemia at the age of 15. A devout Catholic, he used the internet by the early 2000s. At the age of 11, he created a website with an online directory of Eucharistic miracles.
I think that Pope Francis, with his capacity to generate images, is really up to the task to be a communicator for the social media age. We don't have to be fearful to stay there and to evangelize even in this new continent, because it's really a continent. So if we believe that new evangelization is fundamental for the third millennium and our century, we have to stay there. And I think that there is a wonderful continuity between Benedict the 16th and Francis on this particular aspect of communication.
Once a month, the Vatican publishes a Pope video on YouTube. In it, Francis speaks about specific intention and calls on Catholics to unite with him in prayer. Juan de la Torre is part of the team that produces the videos for the Holy Father.
I think that we need to use technology as a tool, right? And we need to understand that we are in a very unfair relationship, because we are just normal people, but then we have the cell phone and we have like the most important minds on earth trying to spend like 1 second more there. So there's a kind of a fight there that we need to realize that we are David and Goliath.
Certainly, the personal testimony is always probably the best way to diffuse the faith, no? And diffuse the gospel. But many times this personal contact comes after a contact through the social media or through the media. So I wouldn't put apart any of them. I would try to say we need to use all of them, and because we are part of the world, and the world today is also the social media. And evangelization certainly is part of the mission of the church. So if we want to evangelize, let's also use the media for that.
In 2,000 years, the mission hasn't changed. Pope Francis, the digital pope, is just adjusting to the modern world. In Rome, Rudolf Gehrich, EWTN News in depth.
We will continue our coverage of Pope Francis's 10th anniversary next week. Tune in to see some of our Catholic heroes that the Holy Father has elevated to the sainthood so far during his pontificate. The week's top headlines are coming up in the Week in Review, including a hearing on abortion pills, the most consequential abortion case since the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Stay with us. The highly criticized Vatican deal with the Chinese Communist Party. What the Holy See's foreign minister is now admitting.
There's a lack of faith in Ireland at the moment, and I'm not exactly sure why.
Plus, despite a decimating decline in mass attendance in Ireland, some youth are providing hope for the future of the church on the Emerald Isle. A major court case in West Texas tops the Week in Review. That's where a federal judge will soon issue a ruling that could force the abortion pill mifepristone off the market. Judge Matthew Cassis Merrick heard arguments in the case on Wednesday in a federal courtroom in Amarillo. On behalf of pro-life medical organizations, the Christian legal group Alliance Defending Freedom asked the judge to issue a preliminary injunction ordering the Food and Drug Administration to withdraw or suspend approval of mifepristone. It is one of two pills used in chemical abortions, which account for more than half of all abortions in America. Justice Department lawyers representing the FDA strongly denied the plaintiff's claim that the drug is unsafe and had not been properly vetted, saying it went through rigorous scientific testing before it was approved more than 20 years ago. Cassis Merrick is widely known for his long-held pro-life views based on his writings and previous work as a lawyer for the conservative legal organization First Liberty. His ruling could have a far-reaching impact.
This federal judge from Texas has the power to halt sales of the abortion pill all across the country. And what's most interesting to me is that it applies to states that are pro-abortion, like my home state of Connecticut, California, and other states.
It would be unprecedented for a judge, a single judge, to say the FDA got it wrong 23 years ago. There's never been an instance where anyone has overturned the ruling of the FDA against the FDA's wishes.
Cassis Merrick said he would issue his ruling as soon as possible. Whatever his decision, court observers say it's virtually guaranteed to be appealed to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and then likely to the U.S. Supreme Court. A group of lawmakers in Colorado continues to forge ahead in efforts to make their state a safe haven for abortion in a region largely dominated by pro-life protections. The Colorado State Legislature has introduced Senate Bill 23190 that would eliminate the option for women to use the abortion pill reversal protocol, a safe and proven progesterone treatment which can stop a chemical abortion. It would also allow minors to enroll themselves in state-funded family planning services without parental consent and add mandatory women's health care services, including full cost of abortion, to large employers' health benefit plans. If passed, the laws could also protect out-of-state women and medical providers in Colorado from interstate investigations. A sobering new report this week about maternal health in America. The rate of Americans dying while giving birth or in the weeks afterward spiked upward by more than one-third in 2021 compared to the year before. Data compiled by the National Center for Health Statistics indicates the sharp jump was significant for all racial and ethnic groups. Although pandemic data was not part of this report, medical experts commenting on the new study say it is natural to believe that COVID may account for at least part of the higher death rate. Research has shown pregnant women infected with the virus have a 7 times higher risk of dying than pregnant women not infected. Tensions continue to simmer at the Mexico-U.S. border. Last weekend, hundreds of migrants brushed past turnstiles and Mexican officers as they tried to rush the U.S. border on the crossing bridge between Mexico and El Paso, Texas. But as soon as they got to the middle of the bridge, they were stopped by U.S. Border Patrol, barricades, and barbed wire. It's not clear what caused the attempted mass crossings. The United Nations Migration Office says it might have been sparked by a rumor that people arriving with children were going to be let in. An official said rumors are a recurring problem because they encourage migrants to leave shelters for crossing attempts, only to find the shelters full when they try to return. Days after Pope Francis likened the Nicaraguan government to Nazi Germany, President Daniel Ortega ordered a suspension of relations between Nicaragua and the Holy See. The Vatican Embassy in Managua and the Nicaraguan Embassy to the Holy See in Rome will close. The Pope, who was speaking about the 26-year prison sentence given to Nicaraguan Bishop Rolando Alvarez, called Ortega unstable. This is the latest in a series of incidents highlighting the breakdown between the Catholic Church and the Ortega dictatorship, which tolerates no criticism. An admission from the Vatican's foreign minister that the controversial Vatican-China deal needs to be renegotiated. During an interview with EWTN News, Archbishop Paul Gallagher said Holy See diplomats are negotiating improvements to the agreement with Beijing. The deal, first signed in 2018, has been renewed twice. Many observers have been harshly critical of the agreement for giving the Chinese Communist government a role in deciding who can be named a Catholic bishop in China.
The objective is to get the best deal possible,
which certainly this agreement is not the best deal possible, because of the other party, they were only prepared to go so far and to agree to certain things. But this was what was possible at the time. It was always going to be difficult. It was always going to be used by the Chinese party to bring greater pressure on the Catholic community, particularly on the so-called underground church. So we just go forward. There
have been some. We will have much more of Bishop Gallagher's interview with our correspondent Colm Flynn next week on EWTN News In Depth. The bishop will share his thoughts on what the Vatican's greatest diplomatic challenges are today and how the Vatican Diplomatic Corps is addressing them. The Diocese of Albany, New York, has declared bankruptcy. Faced with hundreds of lawsuits from the clergy sex abuse scandal, the diocese says it has settled 50 of the more than 400 cases and does not have the resources to settle anymore. A New York state law has allowed a look-back period, during which adults who claim they were victims of sex abuse as children have been able to file civil cases.
Let me first address victim survivors. I am deeply sorry that anyone suffered abuse in the church. While I cannot take away those memories and that pain, I have promised and am committed to walking with you on the road to healing. And that involves more than any financial settlement. You do not have to walk alone.
The bankruptcy filing will allow the diocese to make a reorganization plan to determine available assets. Parishes and Catholic schools of the Albany Diocese will not be affected because they're incorporated separately. Several other New York State dioceses have also filed for bankruptcy. Financial anxieties continue after last weekend's collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, based in California. It was quickly followed by the collapse of New York-based Signature Bank. Poor management and risky investments are believed to have caused the bank failures, which are two of the largest in U.S. history. To shore up confidence in America's banking system, federal officials and the FDIC took extraordinary steps, promising uninsured depositors at Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank that they would be made whole. In a hearing on Capitol Hill, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said the banks themselves have not been rescued and taxpayer money is not being provided to them. She said the focus is on bank customers.
I can reassure the members of the committee that our banking system is sound and that Americans can feel confident that their deposits will be there when they need them. This week's actions demonstrate our resolute commitment to ensure that our financial system remains strong and that depositors' savings remain safe.
Lawmakers on Capitol Hill are now debating whether bank regulations, which have been relaxed in recent years, should be put back in place to strengthen the banking system and create more financial safeguards. The Vatican held its first monthly Eucharistic adoration on Tuesday. The Holy Hour was offered for Pope Francis in honor of his 10th anniversary as Pope. Several hundred adorers gathered in the area in front of St. Peter's Basilica to take part in prayer, music, readings, and moments of silence. This is a new pastoral initiative of St. Peter's Basilica and will take place the second Tuesday of every month. And registration is officially open for the National Eucharistic Congress in the United States. The five-day event is expected to draw tens of thousands of Catholics to Indianapolis, Indiana in July of next year to encounter the living Jesus Christ and beg for revival in the church. It's the first Eucharistic Congress in 83 years. As the world dawns green for St. Patrick's Day, EWTN News In Depth looks at how the church in Ireland has changed. Church leaders and young faithful share their insights. This weekend, we celebrate St. Patrick, the missionary who brought Christianity to Ireland. The Emerald Isle was once a stronghold of the faith, but the numbers of practicing Catholics have steadily declined in the last few decades as a result of the clergy sex abuse scandal and rising secularism. What's the reality of Catholicism in the church in Ireland now? For answers, we turn to our own favorite Irishman, reporter Colm Flynn.
In a small pub in the west of Ireland, a local trad group are playing well into the night. This is a tradition that has been handed down through the generations and is still as strong as ever in Ireland. A few tunes, a pint of Guinness, and chatting with some friends. But while some traditions are being kept alive, the tide has been turning when it comes to other elements of Irish society.
I would consider myself a Catholic, but I don't practice it. I don't have time.
So I feel like I find things more important in life.
So I would consider myself agnostic. Fundamentally, it's probably the scandals that the Catholic Church has been involved in.
Eve, do you grow up Catholic?
I did.
Do you practice religion today?
No.
Years ago, Franciscan friaries like this one behind me were the centres of power across the island of Ireland. And as the centuries went on, the Catholic Church became part of the very fabric of life in Ireland. Ireland was known as one of the most Catholic countries in the world. But today, the Church in Ireland faces a very different type of reality. In the 1950s and 60s, it is estimated that almost 90% of the population of Ireland went to weekly Mass. There was rarely an event or social gathering that didn't have a religious element. However, in 2021, a survey conducted by the Association of Catholic Priests found that only about 30% of Irish Catholics attend Mass on a weekly basis. But still, the latest census figures recorded that 78% of the population still identify as Catholic. To explore this, I went to County Monaghan and sat down with Father Owen Gorman. So why do you think it is that 78% of the population here claim to be Catholic, but when it comes to practicing, they don't? Why do they still identify as Catholic?
Yeah, I think the research in this indicates that Irish people are now identifying with or living Catholicism in a different way. I suppose the older generation would have looked at being a Catholic as a person who they would have went to Mass, they would have went to confession quite regularly. The new generation of Catholics don't necessarily identify with those rituals as strongly. But what they do identify with is living Catholicism in terms of social justice or social inclusion or just having a kind of a charity towards neighbour.
So the markers almost have changed.
Yes, they have, yeah.
As to what it means to be Catholic for some people in this country. For a country that was so Catholic, how did mass attendance and practice of religious faith drop off so dramatically? Bishop Alphonsus Cullohan is the Bishop of Waterford and Lismore.
It was a very devotional church. I wonder how deep it was theologically. Being a very clerical world, that holiness was associated with clerics and religious.
Was it too powerful?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was, there was too much of an emphasis on, there was a bad clericalism.
The Catholic Church did have an immensely positive impact on Irish society. In the 19th century, it set up a network of schools and universities across Ireland. And for the first time in Irish society, people from disadvantaged backgrounds could now get an education. Many of the country's hospitals and clinics were founded by the church. Homeless shelters, community groups, addiction centres, and so on.
I have been very privileged in meeting religious who gave their lives, you know, to the education of young people. And unfortunately, there are many who simply have forgotten that now.
The revelations of the Cloyne report have brought the government, Irish Catholics, and the Vatican to an unprecedented juncture.
Forgotten or ignored because of anger after the so many stories broke of sexual abuse and cover-ups within the Catholic Church in Ireland. The stories that emerged were devastating.
It, you know, it just destroyed the trust that people had in their priests and in their bishops. And, you know, when you lose trust, you know, it's very difficult just to get that to be regained.
And when we talk about the abuse scandals that happened across Ireland, do you think the church did a good job in responding
to that and helping the victims?
I think, Colin, that the church was slow in responding. We have learned so much in the meantime. I think that now we really have a much, much more secure and safe place for children and for vulnerable adults.
The sexual abuse crisis is a big part of the decline, but the numbers of young people practicing their faith had been declining before that.
Growing up in a smaller county, like I'm from Monaghan, there's such a lack of community.
In Dublin, the capital, I meet Ava and Maria, two members of Youth 2000, a community of young believers who organise retreats, talks and religious events.
What is it, do you think, that is stopping so many young people from going to Mass and to church?
To be honest, I don't know. Like, there's a lack of faith in Ireland at the moment, and I'm not exactly sure why. I think it's partially laziness, the people stopped going, and then people stopped seeing and realising what the Catholic faith was about, what you can actually get out of the Catholic faith, and how it helps and improves your life so much.
Like, I think our shepherds, our priests, are not preaching the truth, you know? Like, you know, they think they're giving people what they want by a watered-down Mass or, you know, a shorter homily, but, like, young people are craving the truth. They're craving, a lot of it we're finding is they're craving tradition. They're craving what the church is.
Christ be near, but either hand. Christ behind, before me stand.
In rural parts of Ireland, there are still pockets of strong faith, like here in the parish of Mullaghorin in County Cavan, where local school children are preparing for their confirmation.
Christ be in my heart and mind. Christ be
in anima naher, agus an vic, agus an spirit naev. Amen.
Father P.J. Hughes is the local priest.
This is a country parish, and it has two churches, two fine churches.
And this is a farming area.
Oh, mostly farming, yeah. Farming is the biggest thing here, I suppose.
Father PJ remembers growing up in that Catholic Ireland where faith was so central.
When I was growing up, we said the rosary every night. It was part and parcel of our life. It was the backbone of our life, our faith.
This is a St. Patrick's Day like no other.
In 2020, when COVID struck Ireland, the Irish government released health guidelines which ordered that all non-essential businesses and activities should close. Catholic churches were among those labelled non-essential and in total were closed for 9 months. Father PJ made headlines when he refused to see churches as non-essential and so refused to close his doors.
We are called to worship God. That's the first commandment, to love the Lord your God with all your heart and your soul. God is essential.
Did you have any support from within the Catholic Church here in Ireland?
There was maybe three priests who wrote to me.
From the bishops or anything?
No, there was no support from that side. They were just saying that we had to obey the guidelines from the government. We were encouraged to close the church and that's it.
Father PJ received huge support from the public, but the lack of fight to have the churches kept open from the bishops is something that some say reflects a bigger problem in the hierarchy of the church in Ireland.
The energy is in low supply, and the reason is that we live in a church in Ireland where a lot of the priests now are elderly priests. They put in huge amount of service. We're in a sense an old army, you know, we're an old army. You need youthful vigor in order to launch new evangelizations, new projects and all of that. We're probably more a church better at maintaining things as they are, a church of maintenance, rather than a church of mission.
In years gone by, Ireland was once known for sending young missionary priests and nuns across Africa and all over the world. But today, the average age of a priest in Ireland is 70. And to try and combat this, missionary priests have been coming from places like Africa and India.
It's not going to be the whole solution to the problem because every local church has to bear the fruit of religious vocations. part of the reason of that is undoubtedly the decline of faith within families.
There are beacons of hope for the church in Ireland, with small initiatives being established in various parts of the country, focusing on young people who are already in their faith. The Holy Family Mission in County Waterford is one of them.
This is Holy Family Mission. This is a place that was founded 7 years ago for young Catholics. And it's just a place where like young Catholics between the ages of 18 and 30 who are in the faith come and, I suppose, produce a generation of young people to lead the renewal of the church and who are really just grounded in what the church believes. They basically take a gap year for God.
As a young Catholic in Ireland today, Michael, how do you feel about the state of your faith, the Catholic Church in Ireland?
I am actually really hopeful. Like, and I'm not just saying that, like, I am really hopeful because I believe that we are few in number. Like the Catholics, like, you know, solidly in the faith, particularly young Catholics. And I think, like, when you look, you know, into stories from the Bible, like, you see how God uses just like a remnant, like a small number of people, to actually like spearhead this renewal of faith or to like convert a whole like town or village, you know. So he works from a few the whole time.
What do you think is going to be the future of the Catholic Church in Ireland?
Well, I can see the numbers dwindling, especially in the younger people, but I can also see how fulfilling it is for younger people, for people who really realise what the Catholic faith is about. So it's kind of hard to know what will happen.
This class is going to make their confirmation this year.
If you had to project into the future and take a guess as to what the Catholic Church in Ireland will look like in 10 years' time.
I think, Colm, it will always come down to personal holiness. And in a way, it will be beginning again, starting again. There is a hole in the human heart which only God can fill. No matter what happens, Christ is the answer. He is the way, the truth, and the life. And the human heart will search here, there, and everywhere for meaning. But it will always come back to Him.
In Ireland, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
We wish you a very happy St. Patrick's Day and hope that you'll use this moment to pray for growth in the church in Ireland. That does it for our broadcast this week. Be sure to join us next week, same time, same place, for more stories important to your Catholic life.